What's up, founders? Welcome to the Startup Founder Roadmap. I'm your host, Chris. Today we have a very, very special guest. I know I say that all the time, but this is a very special guest, Eric Grafstrom. And this guy has built and sold the businesses, helps a ton of founders. Like, this is the perfect person to be a guest on this podcast. Eric, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Chris. I hope I live up to that introduction and excited to be here.
So what is it like being in a startup world for you? Like, what makes you love it so much?
You know, it's a good question. You know, because I tell people, I mean, I've been doing this for close to 30 years, you know, despite the youthful glow of my moneymaker here. you know, I think you just, you get enthralled with this opportunity to take something from an idea and knowing that it necessarily doesn't have the odds of succeeding. And I think that excites you. It's the opportunity to build something. The thought of taking something that exists and optimizing it and scaling it, which has its own set of challenges and requires a talent, is just different than this idea of, well, I'm starting with a blank sheet of paper. And I think for some people that's confusing, frustrating, potentially terrifying. I think for others like me, I couldn't do it any other way.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. For me, I love that inspiration I get from just trying to make something work and building something from the ground up. It's super fun for me trying to see what people like, what they don't like, how much they're willing to pay for that solution. Like, and also for me personally, I like solving the problems. Like the problems I had in podcasting early on, I genuinely love the feeling I get when people tell me, oh man, I'm thankful you made this thing because it helped me with this. And I'm like, wow, that's the exact problem I had. And you don't have to experience the pain that I did. Like, I love that part of it. It saves me. It gives me a lot of inspiration.
Cool. Yeah. No, there's an endorphin rush of seeing something that you took from an idea rattling around in your brain to maybe getting some help and pulling together and seeing it implemented in some capacity. And, you know, even if it's $20, I mean, it doesn't have to be millions of dollars. Just seeing someone being like, yep, I want that, is just this crazy feeling that I think I have and will continue to, you know, desire no matter what I do.
I love that. I love it. So let's get into some of the starter stuff, man. I want to really get into first team building, right? I see a lot of companies now that are being built where people are millionaires. They're making really good money and they don't have a massive team. Do you believe that a team is necessary to building that $10 million plus company?
I mean, yeah, I do. And I'll tell you why, but I also look, entrepreneurship has different flavors and, you know, I've been a part of Silicon Valley startups. I've been a part of startups that have succeeded in things that have, I mean, failed spectacularly. So, you know, today I work with a lot of small business owners. And so those are Main Street businesses. So entrepreneurship means a wide array of things. It could be a tech startup in bleeding edge technology. It could be a carpet cleaning business. And so, you know, for me, you know, as somebody who I started my career, you know, at a company, I was a journalism major and had no idea what was in front of me. And so many people helped me along the way. So team means different things to answer your question. Team may be people who are employed or contracted to work with you on your startup. It also may be mentors, advisors. It may be, you know, service providers. There are going to be people that you're going to need to rely on along the way to get you to the next level. And then from there to that next level. So I think the idea of doing it solely on your own, you know, is kind of a pipe dream. I mean, you may say, well, I just have two people, you know, on my team, quote unquote. Well, that's who you're paying. But the reality is your team may be, you know, a contractor you found on Upwork who somehow unlocks some magic with marketing automation. It may be other people. So you're going to have a team of people and it depends on how you define it. And so, you know, look at how you need help and where you're going to get that help from. And that's your team. So, you know, be open-minded to that definition is what I'd say. And make sure you're hiring good people. We could talk a little bit more about some of that too, but You have to have some form of a team along the way.
Yeah, I think the team is important. But for me, I can say I honestly don't want a massive team. I'll be honest and say I don't want to be the person that has to manage like 50 plus people. That just sure. is a lot to me. Like I don't. Yeah. When I think of my ideal yeah. business and my ideal life, it doesn't include managing 50 people. That's just a lot for me.
Yeah. And I would say the term I would use is in look, I share some of that kind of mentality, which is a team doesn't necessarily have to be direct reports. I don't want a whole bunch of direct reports at this stage in my career. Some people think that that's what it means. But I think, you know, a team may be people who come alongside you who aren't reporting to you necessarily, or maybe they are. But yeah, no, I totally get the you know, do you want to manage a lot? And I, quite frankly, I think managing people in organizations in and of itself is its own skill set, and recognizing whether that's something you're good at and want to do is really important, because as you go from being someone, you know, who may be working by yourself into building something up, that may be something that you want to bring in as somebody who's kind of more of a people and operations type manager.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. I think that's something that you should be hiring for. So what's that first hire like, or better yet, when should you make that first hire? I'm a startup founder. I got my idea. I've got some validation. I've even gotten a couple customers in the door all by myself. And I feel I'm sure. getting inspired and I'm motivated. I feel like I can do a lot more by myself. Yeah. But when would you advise that kind of founder to make that first hire?
I think one is that hire should be effectively curing a pain point. And you know, there's certainly, you know, something to be said for having to work hard. But when you're looking at it, you have to stop and say, okay, I can't do all this by myself. And I'm incurring some type of pain, right? Whether it's lost revenue, too many hours in the day, you know, spent working. There's a variety of things that maybe cause it. But I think what's most important is to take a step back. And I always kind of look at it and like I draw a little, you know, in my mind mentally, I draw a line between here's things that I'm really good at and I enjoy doing. Here's things in the middle that I'm okay at. I can get them done. I don't particularly enjoy doing them. And then there's things that either I can't do, coding, maybe whatever it may be, or if I do it, I'm detracting value from my business. And so, you know, when you're in those early days, I think it's important to really kind of focus on, okay, what is it going to take to kind of grow the business? What's holding you back when it comes to your first hire? And find somebody who may be focused on somewhere in those last two, which is something that, you know, you just can't do on your own, or you're just doing a terrible job of it, or you don't enjoy doing. And bringing in a true professional, maybe elevating, you know, whether it's the service offering or the product design or something like that. But what's going to elevate the game? It's not just solving that point. What's going to elevate the game and take the startup to the next level?
Yeah. I think as founders, we probably, because starting off, you kind of have this mindset of, I want to do everything because I have to do everything.
Yeah, it's natural.
Yeah, but I think we got to evolve past that stage of
yes, you do.
Wearing all the hats. Like wearing all the hats is okay. And I think it's even necessary early on, but I've been learning that you have to be willing to kind of pass the baton a bit and let some other people come in and help you.
Yeah, I you know, and again, I come up with these little pithy things that may or may not be helpful, but I say, you know, when it comes to building a team, step one, find people that are smarter and better than you. And you know, that depending on where you are in life and your career, it's for some people that may be a difficult thing to say. I hope I'm surrounded by people that are wildly smarter or more talented than me. Two is build trust with them, because the trust that you're going to get, I'm not sure what just happened there.
it's the reactions. If I do it, it pops up too. It's not you. It's
all right, I'll sit on my hands. I'll sit on my hands. I don't know what's going to come up next. So one, you know, find people that are smarter than you and better at their craft than you are. Two is to build trust. And then step three is then your job is to get out of the way and empower them to do what they do really, really well. And I think sometimes people will say, well, like, I need somebody to do X. And if someone's really talented, let's just say sales or product design or marketing, your job is not to tell them how to do their job. Your job is to make sure that like they're 100 times better than you at selling or product design or coding or whatever it may be than you are. And then develop a level of trust so you can get out of their way. Because the reality is really, really talented people, they want that level of autonomy. They want to know that they're working on something. They need some level of guidance and coordination. But really talented people want to know that you are building them up and empowering them to do what they're really good at and what brings them joy and what makes them thrive. Not simply saying like, did you do these 27 tasks the way I want them done, when I wanted them to done, how I wanted them to get done. That's a recipe for disaster. So it's kind of a really smart, build trust, get out of the way and empower them.
I like the get out of the way part. I've actually, me doing what I do with my podcast agency, that's one of the hardest things is getting some of these startups or some of these founders to just kind of just back away a bit while we do the podcast strategy or production and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm the podcast guy. You brought me in to do podcasting. Let me run the show and then you make the content. And that is, I think ego is something that stops a lot of founders from getting out of their way there.
I think you're right. I think it's ego. I think it's fear are two big drivers, which is I've been doing this, you know, well enough so far that I've gotten it to this point where we're driving a little bit of revenue, we're getting some attention, and that nothing wrong with that. But to really kind of scale something, you had better find those people who really kind of say, look, I'm the expert in marketing. I'm the expert in, you know, selling, whatever it may be, you know, and if getting them their dry cleaning or, you know, ordering a different monitor so that they can do it, their job better is what it takes. Do those things, because otherwise you really are, you're going to inhibit their ability to execute at the highest level. And often, and in some cases, you're going to drive them away and you're going to degrade your talent level because it's just somebody who really just doesn't care and they're not committed and they're just there to collect a paycheck and do what they're told to do.
Yeah, and it won't be as good. I think when you alienate people in that way, they just can't execute as good. It's really hard. The outcome of whatever they're doing, it just doesn't work. So I wanted to bring up your company exit guide. How important is having that team built when you're trying to exit your company, when you're trying to make that sale?
Well, it's huge. So the backstory is I spent a long time in early stage tech startups, lived in Silicon Valley for 17 years and found myself, I had worked with a couple companies that were in distress situations. So raised money, got in over their skis and didn't know what to do and was getting brought in to assess the situation, figure out what to do, and then try to go do it. And so in some cases, we're able to, you know, turn things around, put the company in good standing, bring in a new management team. Other cases, it you know, made sense just to simply sell off the assets and you know, somebody else would take over. And in a handful of cases, it was shutting it down. And I decided to kind of take that experience from Silicon Valley tech startups, which has its own laws of gravity and in, you know, ways that it works, and move that into small Main Street business owners. So the people I work with today, you know, that are customers of Exit Guide are, you know, it's the HVAC business, it's the local coffee shop, it's somebody who has a business that it's not going to attract business brokers, M&A advisors, and we help them move through the process. So that's the backdrop. In every case, whether it's a Silicon Valley startup or whether it's a small business in Cleveland, Ohio that sells furniture, if somebody's coming in to take that business over, one of the key questions that they're going to ask above and beyond the financials is, what's the owner dependency? And if you are the business, owner dependency. And if you are the business, and this is a hard thing to explain to some people, especially if they're driving decent revenue, is they'll say, this is a great business. The problem is, you're the business. They're going to say, let's just assume, you know, Chris, you have a coffee shop. You know, if you're the only one that can make the coffee a certain way and you own all the customer relationships, everything, like the minute you leave, you know, I, as a potential buyer, I'm going to say, well, wait a minute, man. Like I can't, you know, I'm going to lose 50% of the revenue. It's going to walk out the door. It's especially true actually in service-based businesses, right? Where you're executing on contracts, you know, lawyers, CPAs, digital marketing agencies that are really small,
yeah,
development shops. And people say, like, what's a great business? I'm like, it is for you. But the minute that you leave, what am I buying?
Because in most agencies, like, the clients come from referrals. It's relationships.
Well, so, and, like, and trust. Like, if, yeah, if I hire you as your podcast agency and you leave, they're like, well, now everything's on the table. And they're like, well, no, all this team is good. And be like, well, that may be, but I've been working with Chris for 4 years and I know the way he does things and in the end result is always awesome. It's always the top, like, it's top flight. And they're like, well, we'll do the same. I'm like, maybe you will, but now you're giving me a reason to take a step back and say, okay, Chris is gone. Should I look at two or three other options here before I make any type of commitment? So that owner dependency becomes a huge, huge factor as you're building your business. And look, I get the ego feed it can be of everybody saying, like, Chris is the best and we love this and it's all awesome. Yeah. And, you know, you feel needed, you wanted, there's joy in delivering something that you're good at to people who are willing to pay for it and see value in it. But if you want to exit, are they doing business with the business or are they doing business with you?
And this is an interesting conversation because I think the term personal branding is bigger than ever now. And a lot of people are building, they're building personal brands and they also built a business that's attached to the personal brand. And because you marry the two, you can't separate it. And I think that's a huge problem, whether it's a newsletter or an agency. I see this a lot where people's entire business is built on them and who they are personally and not like the systems or the processes or even the team.
Well, case in point. So we, most of our traffic comes from, you know, pay-per-click advertising or organic traffic. So people come through. Our goal is to kind of take the LegalZoom business model of automating a kind of a opaque, confusing process and bring it online and supplement it with professional support. So we'll help people go from, okay, what is my business worth and what are the documents? How do I get prepared? And then, you know, where they need help, they can pay for coaching and some other services. We had a client who's still with us. She's currently not active and paying for it, but she came to us and she had built a business that I think is you know, low seven figures, but it's attached to her name. Now, where she was smart is she said, I want to exit this in 2 years. And so she came in the door with a new domain and a desire to exit, but she realized she didn't know what she needed to do to kind of get to that point. So that's where she employed our platform and our services. But she had to basically work very proactively, and that's where she is now. I can't necessarily help her with exit. She needs to go execute on these things. But you're 100% right, Chris, in that, you know, if you build up this personal brand and you're on Twitter and all these other things, the day that you exit or decide you want to exit, you know, it's very rare that someone can take over your personal brand and succeed with it. And if they do, they're going to probably want a discount off of it, as they should, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And or you need to say, okay, I need to make this shift away. Now, if you plan to work for 10 years and then shift into something else, retire, go into a whole new field, and you want to keep that personal brand, that's great. But I can tell you, this isn't my opinion. This is just fact in the marketplace. This is, you build a huge personal brand that drives revenue associated with that personal brand, it is going to come at a discount when you try to exit it and someone else tries to take that over.
That makes so much sense to me. Like, I get it because I'm in business and I have to get clients and customers and all of that stuff. Yeah. I couldn't imagine it being reliant on somebody else's reputation or who they know. And it just, it's not the best approach to business and company building in general. I think it comes down to what you want though. Like you said, because with my podcast companies, I don't plan on selling. I love what I do. I don't plan on selling in, I don't know, it would take like 50 million plus to get me to sell any of it. I just love what I do.
Noted, right? If I want to bring you a deal, it's got to be 50 million. I talked to the guy.
Right. So I got another thing on this. What do you think about these other businesses like newsletters? I've seen a ton of newsletters being bought and sold in the past couple of years, and it's become a new phenomenon where people are building newsletters and brands and then selling them off. Is that something that you and your company Exigot are into?
I mean, we not really. Here's the reason. Small businesses in the U.S. accounts for about 40% of our GDP.
Yeah, a lot.
So it's huge. And about 90% are really, really small, meaning they're worth less than $5 million. So newsletters, podcasts, even my 20 plus year career in you know, SaaS and the internet and venture backed companies, all that other stuff, it really is a relatively small part of the overall economy. Now, you can get into the impacts Meta and others have on the stock market, and that's just a different thing. The saying goes, the stock market is not the economy. They're different things. But, you know, where we see a huge gap in the market is that kind of Main Street business owner. It's massive, and, you know, they're not as digitally savvy in some cases in terms of how to use tools. And that's where there's a huge, huge pain point. 85% of these things are owned by Gen X and baby boomers. So you also have this huge demographic, you know, issue, which is, you know, a bunch of people who own most of these businesses are all over the age of 60. So, you know, time is going to push them to do something here. You know, newsletters, you know, there's Acquire, Micro Acquire and other companies that Flippa and others that I feel like do a pretty good job of servicing those things. But the other thing, and not to sound like the naysayer, the things we hear about are kind of the exceptions to the rule, because that's the cool stuff to report on. They don't talk about the other, you know, 9 out of 10 that fall flat on their face, or they generate $400 a month or whatever it may be. So I've lived through all the booms and busts. You know, if you're not in love with the problem that you're trying to solve with your newsletter, your podcast, your SaaS offering, or whatever it may be, this is going to be a really tough and long journey that may not result in what you want.
That's interesting, because I see that as the most popular, but I do agree that like the laundromat down the street or the tire shop, like those kind of small businesses really make America go, man. It's so many, they're everywhere. And I think more people understand it than like in this digital space, I think we kind of take for granted. And like we think, well, if I know how to make a landing page and do all of this stuff, then everybody else does. The truth is, most other humans you meet have no idea what's going on in this space, like none whatsoever. It's kind of hilarious when you really think about it.
And you add to that, they're doing just fine. Like they live in a nice community and they have a, you know, food on the table and they're enjoying their lives. And, you know, again, I grew up in this space. Like I if you asked me to go work at a regular company that was not in tech, I'm sure I'd be a disaster. So I love this world, but at the same time, someone say like, how can you not know about, like, you know, the guy who runs the HVAC company with, you know, 12 trucks and 30 employees and has no idea what a landing page is, has never registered for a Twitter account. He's making $300K a year and he's going to sell his business for $10 million. It happens all the time. Most of the wealth in this country comes from two things, real estate and small business. The stories that are in the press are the 25-year-old out of Stanford who dropped out and blah, blah, blah. But statistically speaking, if you are under the age of 35 and you want the highest likelihood of becoming a millionaire by the time you're 50, do not go into early stage tech. Go into a service-based industry, plumbing, HVAC, whatever it may be. Find a small business owner who's over the age of 60 who will mentor you and eventually sell you his or her business. If you can do that and that business is currently generating, you know, at least $750,000 a year in revenue and you can stick with it for 15 plus years, that is the greatest likelihood of when you'll become a millionaire, bar none. This isn't me making this up. This is what all the economic data suggests, and AI ain't going to replace plumbers.
I know, right? Like that's another thing that the AI movement, I think it's creating more buzz and frenzy, but again, it's still us, the same people in the ecosystem. I don't believe that AI is necessarily adding people to our ecosystem to where we can say that the tech industry or SaaS can compete with local businesses. I still don't think we're even close to that. Like, I use ChatGPT pretty much every day. Maybe one of my family members knows what it is. Nobody else knows. They have no idea.
Your holidays are probably like mine. What do you do? He works with computers. And you're just like, yeah, it's fine.
That's exactly what it is. I think we gotta, as founders, we have to understand that, like, I think when you say you want to be a real entrepreneur or a digital founder or something like that in the online virtual, like, internet space, you're moving to a completely, like, outside realm of society. Because most of the stuff that we even think about, the average person is just completely unaware it exists. And I still think we're, like, maybe 10 to 15 years off of them, like, even catching up. Because, like, when I look at online courses, it's, I think most people would benefit from some kind of online course. But, again, that's another one of those things where people just, they have no idea. It's, like, it's a whole nother universe to them. It's kind of mind-blowing sometimes, man.
It really is. And you mentioned landing pages. I think it's a great example. Let's just project 2 years from now. So we're 2026, February 2026. Will you be able to use AI to say, design 4 variations of a landing page, implement a split traffic, you know, for, you know, 30 days and identify, you know, the winner from that result, you know, with this type of, you know, you give it those instructions, which we're kind of close today. So let's just say, you know, February of 2026, what is the likelihood of that being able to get implemented versus come to my house, you know, install a new washer and dryer so that I can get my laundry done? And so when people say, like, it's going to be disruptive, I'm like, it will, but who's not going to have a job in February of 2026? The person who's out there kind of using Optimizely and all the other tools to design those landing pages and has all this, you know, insight and knowledge and experience and mental pattern recognition, or the plumber who's going to say, well, you know, because you've got a gas hookup, here's the kind of dryer you're going to need, and, you know, so on and so forth. And, like, you know, I'll be back tomorrow. Like, so AI is going to disrupt, but you and I live in a world where the disruption and the job displacement is going to probably see its biggest impact versus, as you kind of point, the rest of the world, you know, is out there and they're doing just fine and they will be impacted and they will see their lives hopefully improved in many aspects. But entrepreneurship is a very broad term that describes a big, you know, approach to business. And you kind of need to be able to kind of look at the whole market and how you're playing a role in it. I mean, even newsletters, like, I mean, will someone be able to say, like, help me craft a newsletter that will see this type of open rate, click-through rate and engagement rate and things like that and write articles for me and things like that. And you could say it's the prompt engineer, but you're like, yeah, but there used to be people who actually wrote those and then people who designed the emails and the graphics and yada, yada, yada. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, for sure, man. I love what you're doing in this world of working with the small businesses. I know that in, like, the next 5 to 10 years, most of those boomers that have the businesses, Gen X, a lot of them are kind of going to be out of here. And somebody's going to have to take over those companies, you know, because right now, if I call a plumber, it's going to be hard to get a plumber on the line. It's actually difficult to work with small local businesses. It is very challenging. And I think if some of the digital entrepreneurs move into that space and kind of combine the worlds, they could be really, really profitable. That's where I think a massive opportunity is if you can take your digital experience with, like, some skills in the outside world in the service space and put them together, I think you could build something incredible.
I think not only do I think that's right, you're seeing if you're active on Twitter, I'm never going to call it X. It's just dumb.
Never.
If you're active on Twitter, there's, I feel like, you know, I don't smoke, but at times I feel like I should have the unfiltered Camels or Pall Malls and be like, rrr. But, you know, there's a huge movement for people that are doing self-funded searching and things like that. I see a lot of hope in people that are younger, that are exploring this. I think it's awesome. I mean, go. A couple of things that I would, you know, say is, one, don't assume that these owners are dumb just because they don't necessarily use, you know, MailChimp or other things that haven't optimized their business. They are probably a millionaire and you are not. They're doing something right. They understand business. Now, maybe they don't understand the latest digital trends and you could optimize things and make them more efficient. Totally. But they probably also know that too. They just haven't taken the time and energy to put into it. And that may be because family, busy with business, making great money, didn't want to, couldn't do it, inept, who knows. But if you're looking at it, I know a guy named Alex out of Cincinnati who he graduated, you know, he was newly married with, graduated from college, newly married, baby, I think very close to being on the way, and turned down a job at Procter & Gamble, which I'm sure, wow. I don't know his parents, may have made his parents like have a heart attack. But the thing is he had a business that he had started in college to help him fund his school of designing websites for blue collar businesses. So there's different ways to approach this. You could say, I want to take it over, but you could also say, hey, look, all these businesses need help. And if you can make it affordable and execute well, just helping them with some of the basics of making their business more efficient is your own, you know, service provider in your own local community. You don't need to get people from all over the world or in the US. You may just say, I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm really great at these things. Well, you know, instead of trying to go out and become a digital agency working with the local startup community, like maybe join the Chamber of Commerce and see who you can help there. There's probably a lot of people that are over the age of 45 that are be like, look, if for $500 a month, you could just do these three things for me and I don't have to worry about it. That'd be great. You may say that's not a lot of money. Well, 10 of them, 20 of them, 30 of them. And, you know, once you kind of get them through that kind of front loaded process of getting up and running, you may actually have an awesome business on your hands. Yeah. And so this is a huge part of our economy that I think oftentimes gets underlooked for understandable reasons, but there are plenty of ways that we can help kind of that kind of Main Street business owner.
Yeah, man, this is good. I could go through this all day. I love these conversations about business from that, kind of from the outside perspective. It's a little different, not the traditional, or the usual stuff we see in this space on a podcast. It's always like, oh, what's your cat or like all of that stuff. It just gets kind of redundant, honestly. We hear it and see it all the time. So I'm glad we could take the conversation in this route. Cool. What is one piece of advice you would give to somebody that is trying to exit their business?
Prepare. This is like selling a house. And I think what gets overlooked off too often because people don't know about the process is they start with, okay, my business, you know, should be worth this amount of money. And again, there's nothing wrong with this, but over 50% of small business transactions fail during due diligence. And so what that means is people skip this step. And the analogy I often draw is you wouldn't sit there on a Saturday morning and be like, you know what? It's time to move. I'm going to sell my house and then just stick a sign in the yard. You'd be like, that's crazy, man. Like you've got like, you didn't finish painting the bedroom. You know, your garage is just a mess. You got four dead trees in your backyard. Like, dude, you got to clean this up. You probably should, you know, maybe kind of have somebody like an electrician or somebody come through, make sure there's no problems. You know, that is a total common sense thing that we do. So you're preparing your house to sell it. And you oftentimes would either go onto something like Zillow or Redfin and you'd look at comps in your neighborhood and you'd say, okay, these houses are selling between, you know, whatever, $400,000 and $650,000. So I'm not going to expect $900,000 for my house. You might talk to an agent. So preparation is so fundamentally key. So when we started this, I had a thesis. One is that too many small business owners were getting overlooked in terms of being able to access these resources, largely because resources are getting paid on hourly rates and commission. So naturally, they're going to focus on businesses that are worth at least $5 million. Yeah. There's a lot of them, but 90% of them are worth somewhere between $250,000 and $2.5 million. So how do we help them? And then the other part of it is I think the challenge is not necessarily finding a buyer, but it's the steps leading up to, you know, being able ready to consummate a transaction, getting that transaction done. So a big part of our platform walks people through a, you know, using a dashboard, what they need to do and how to organize that. And people say, is that of value? I'm like, well, we've helped thousands of people. About 45% know who they're going to sell their business to. family member, business partner, employee, someone in the local community. Another 15 to 20% have no idea what they want to do. And so they may not be able to sell their business, and they're going to need a plan, whether it's selling the assets. So a bulk of the market, you know, needs to go through this education process and this preparation process before they can even tell somebody that they might want to sell it. So, you know, prepare, learn what your options are, and please, please, please do this well in advance of when you're ready to kind of exit your business. You're in a very difficult and unfavorable position if you're like, I need to sell this in the next 3 months for whatever reason. Well, it's like, it's going to take you, you're not going to probably be totally prepared. We'll do our best to help you. We can certainly put you in a much better position than you would be otherwise. But now someone's looking at a business that's going to need some work just to clean it up before they're ready to actually make an offer. And so that's going to impact you.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds right, man. Be ready and have all your ducks in a row so that if you want to sell, you can kind of cut down that processing time. I imagine that you can eliminate a lot of that time by just being ready to sell. Man, this was such a good conversation, man. I love learning this stuff.
Yeah, talking to you.
Let me thinking about buying a laundromat or something, man, or a tire shop or something.
you'll be running your podcast with the noise of those, you know, pneumatic drills or washing machines clanking around in the background. People are like, well, I like him, but like, there's all this weird noise in the background. Yeah.
I've thought about a lot of this stuff, man. Where can people find you and more about the Exit Guide?
Sure. Just exitguide.com. My email address is eric@exitguide.com. And, you know, if you listen to this podcast and want to reach out, mention Chris, please. I always like to know where leads are coming from. And you know, we can certainly, you know, provide a discount on a coaching session for listeners of your podcast. So just email me directly, eric@exitguide.com, mention Chris and his podcast, and we'd love to help.
All right, man. Eric, thank you again for being on the show. This was great.
I appreciate it, Chris. Thanks so much.